I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. It's our monthly book show. Last month, we asked our book experts to share their top 10 must-read favorite books of all time. A tough assignment, and in fact, we only got through their top five. So today, part two of their must-reads. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Robert Waxler, recently retired English professor at UMass Dartmouth. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mindy.
A quick reminder of, because, you know, I know this changes, and probably what you brought for the top five the six through ten is different now. Mm-hmm. But last month, Bob, your five that we got to were Anna Karenina, The Great Gatsby, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Catcher in the Rye, and The Stranger. Jill, you were also Anna Karenina, Lolly Willows or The Loving Huntsman, The Making of Americans, Being a History of a Family's Progress, Time Will Darken, and High Rising. So, and we'll have a list later to all the details of everything we talk about. So my big question is, did your list change this end of this list while we had this last month to think about
it? I see one of us is shaking his head, yes.
Yeah, mine certainly changed in terms of the next five as I thought about it. In fact, one of them changed while I was driving here. So there is this kind of fluidity, which I think is a good thing because there are so many good books, as we said last time, and the favorites 1 week are not necessarily the favorites the next week. That's in part because the books from 1 week are almost always very, very good. But life changes, the world changes, and I think the books, when you read them, change as well.
Yeah.
It's part of the process of reading.
Well, and I want to say that I actually have stuck with the ones that I picked for last time. However, I also just want to shout out to the book club that wrote me an email after the last show and suggested that they were going to actually try to read Gertrude Stein's The Making of Americans as part of their book club. Mm. And I was very, very impressed that they even were considering this. And then she did sort of back down and say, well, maybe parts of Making of Americans, not the whole thing. Right. But congratulations for even opening the book. It's still an amazing book. And I want to emphasize, which we did last time, these are our top 10.
Right, your top 10.
And there is a book that has come out called My Ideal Bookshelf. And in this, it sort of talks about what that is for you to pick your book. And it's some you know just by the color of their dust jackets. One is in tatters. It was passed down by your mother, and it's dog-eared and carefully held together by tape and tenderness. The closer you look, the trickier the task turns out to be. And I think that's true. The closer you look at your bookshelves, the more you wonder what is going to make that top 10?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a tough decision.
All right. And then, of course, we still want to hear from you if you have thoughts of your favorite book you'd like to add to our list. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. You can also shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Bob, what's your number six?
Well, after we did Anna Karenina last time, which we both agreed was one of the great books, and perhaps the greatest novel.
You both chose it, yeah.
I began to think that there must be a book written in English, a novel written in English that comes close to Anna Karenina. And in my own mind, at least, went through the possibilities, and I came up with Middlemarch by George Eliot. The Marianne Evans was her original name. And as I thought about Middlemarch, I said, you know, this looks to me as the best book ever written in English. I decided that for sure when I was writing here to come on the radio show today. So I want to try to defend that a little bit, because there are obviously a lot of really excellent books. But I think that one thing that you get from Middlemarch that you don't necessarily get from a lot of other very good books written in English is an elegance of style, which is extraordinarily, to me, extraordinarily unique, the craftsmanship and the way George Eliot puts a sentence together is absolutely remarkable. This is high culture, and I'm drawn to that because it's as if when I read a sentence from George Eliot, there are hooks in it. There are ironies within ironies, and I can begin to see that at the surface she's perhaps talking about ordinary life, but as I move deeper into the sentence itself, there's a rhythm of something that's deep, that's mysterious, that has about it a kind of illumination. It's almost a miracle. And when I think about Middlemarch, which is a very long book, I also think about the extraordinary intelligent energy that George Eliot has put into it, and that energy gets transferred from the book to the reader inevitably. It's as if you're reading an epic work in a sense, because you get an incredible feeling about a whole period of time. It's the early 1830s, but you see the details of that period, the Reform Bill. There are lawyers, there are all kinds of professional people, bankers, doctors, landed gentry, workers. They're all there in this provincial area that she's created. And so you've got a tremendous extension of what it must have been like during that period. And she does such a wonderful job of that, that as you read it, you realize that the important things that are going on in that period at that level are also very similar to the kinds of things that go on today. And at the same time, as you go further and further out into the social world that she's created, you have a large number of individual characters, and she goes so deeply into the interior of those characters that I find it totally remarkable. I have never seen a book that, in that sense, seems to go so deep into each individual and at the same time extend way out into the social environment.
I like when you said irony within an irony, because when you said, I'm like, that's a book that you can read over and over because you're going to miss stuff the first time and catch it the next time.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. All right. Jill, what's your number six?
Well, my number six was inevitable, and I have to say, I tried not to choose any children's books, but found it was impossible not to. And I think that when you first learn to read, and when you were learning as a child, those books stick with you in
forever.
A way, yeah, in a way that nothing else ever will again. And I could have done, 10 top kids books, but this I did another show, but I did in fact have to bring a couple, and one of them, of course, I would say, is Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. Mm. It is such a beautiful story. It is so well written. And it is also a book that just deeply stays with you once you've read it. I've reread it many times, and it's still just such a great story. But what I did not know until just this week was that when it first came out in the New York Times, it was Eudora Welty who reviewed the book for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And she wrote this great paragraph about the book, about what this book is about. And for those few of you that don't know what this book is about, and she wrote, "What the book is about is friendship on earth, affection and protection, adventure and miracle, life and death, trust and treachery, pleasure and pain, and the passing of time. As a piece of work, it is just about perfect and just about magical in the way it is done. What it all proves in the words of the minister in the story, which he hands down to his congregation after Charlotte writes some pig in her web, is, quote, that human beings must always be on the watch for the coming of wonders. Dr. Dorian says in another place, oh no, I don't understand it. But for that matter, I don't understand how a spider learned to spin a web in the first place. When the words appeared, everyone said they were a miracle. But nobody pointed out that the web itself is a miracle. the author will only say Charlotte was in a class by herself.
You know, that is the first book I recall really being drawn. You know, you get read to and you read some of those little golden books and they were, but this is the one that really captured me.
Well, and I think it makes you a reader. I mean, once you've read Charlotte's Web as a kid, you're going to be a reader, unless of course you're not. But if you have any reason to think you might want to be a reader, this book is going to do it. And this book also was a book that my mother also read aloud to me. And so I've both got the memory of reading it myself and the memory of my mother reading it to me. So Charlotte's Web has got to be on my top 10.
And how could E.B. White not be on one of our top 10 lists?
That's right. That's right. This is true.
So well, it excites the imagination, too. Yeah. I think that's part of what
That's a good pick. And just a reminder that you don't have to take notes through the show. We will have a little bit later on today, we'll have a list to all of the books we talked about today and the books we talked about last month that will be at our website, capeandislands.org. We're going to talk more after a quick break. Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about 10 best reads, favorite books of our two book experts this morning. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Robert Waxler, recently retired English professor at UMass Dartmouth. All right, we're up to book 7, Bob. What's next?
Well, Middlemarch is such a long book. I began to think that I should try to choose some books that are relatively short, which would be, you know, perhaps more reasonable. You could pick them up and perhaps read them in even one sitting or close to it. So the second book that I have is Old Man and the Sea by Hemingway. It's a relatively short book, but I think it is just, again, an outstanding book. More than anything else for me, it presents this character, Santiago, the old man, who really represents a kind of heroism. He's an example of a hero precisely because he doesn't give up. It's a sense of endurance. When the story opens, he's been out fishing for 84 days, almost 3 months. He is not looked upon very well in terms of the village and the community who value fishing because he hasn't really caught any fish over that period. And you get a picture of a guy in that context who gets up every morning, struggles, goes out, comes home at night, has not caught anything, and goes back to sleep that night. But then gets up the next morning as if it's a new day, a different day. Each day is a new day, as Hemingway puts it. And so after a while, you begin to think, well, you know, how many people can do this? Would I do this? If I had to get up every morning and I went out all day with some goal in mind, came home disappointed, didn't have what I had hoped to achieve, how many days would I be able to maintain that? So I begin to get the feeling, and people reading this get the feeling, that it's in the rhythm of this guy, this old man, that kind of endurance has a tremendous heroic value, that there's something about that makes him strange and unique, and that he deserves the attention that, as readers, we want to pay him. And it really becomes inspirational to think about the fact that he's going to go out there every day, and he's going to make the struggle. So one day he gets up, it's the 85th day, and that's the day. That's the day that he finally hooks a marlin, a huge fish. And then we have this incredible battle between him and the fish. It's really a life and death battle. As he says a couple of times, either I'm going to die, fish, talking to the fish, or you're going to die. And he says, you know, a draw is, it won't help us at all. One of us has to win in that sense, and the other has to lose. But it's part of Hemingway's notion that a person can be defeated, because in the end we are all defeated, which is part of what I think Hemingway wants us to consider. We're all mortal in that sense. A man can be destroyed, but a man does not necessarily have to be defeated, or a human being. And as long as you keep up the struggle and keep moving on, even though you will eventually be destroyed by death, if nothing else, you do not necessarily have to be defeated, which is a great heroic possibility.
Yeah. As you're talking about this, you know, he gets up every day, it's a new day, and he doesn't give up. I'm thinking, I had an uncle who once said, you can't fail if you keep trying. And that's sort of what this is.
That's
you
right.
can't fail if you keep trying.
Yeah. Yeah. And he doesn't do that. And that's what makes it so heroic.
Yeah.
I have, there's a story that I have about this in terms of a reading group. We read Old Man and the Sea. This was a group from the Changing Lives for Literature program, which I do with some criminal offenders and others. And we finished reading it, and then we go on usually to another book the next time. But a guy came in at the beginning of the next session before we started the next book. And he said, I'd like to say a couple of things about Old Man and the Sea that we didn't get to. It was an issue. And he said, you know, I was walking down Union Street, which is one of the main streets in New Bedford, during the, you know, after the class, and I stopped at the corner. And many of you know that I've been having a rough time. I've been seriously thinking about going back to drugs. And I stood at that corner. I was about ready to make the turn. And we all knew what he meant. Mm-hmm. He was going to make the turn back into his old neighborhood, and he was going to get drugs again. And he said, at that moment, just as I was thinking about making the turn, I also thought about Santiago. It was like I heard the voice of Santiago there. And it was as if he had become a friend in my heart. Mm-hmm. And I had a sense, you know, he would always be a friend in that guy's heart from then on. And Santiago was metaphorically at least saying to him, look what I've done. It was 84 days. I was in despair, you know, terrible situation. Look at my hands, they're filled with scars. I had nothing. But I got up the next morning and I did it again. And I remember the guy looking at me and he said, Professor Waxler, I can't guarantee you what's going to happen a day or two from now, but I can tell you that on that day I did not make that turn back into my own neighborhood.
Because he read that book, yeah.
It was because he read the book. Because, in my mind, this is what literature was all about, yeah. The power of literature.
Absolutely.
Santiago had saved his life.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's too much of an exaggeration.
Yeah.
He had heard the voice of Santiago. He had read that book. Santiago, as a character in a book, had suddenly become alive for him and inspired him.
Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Jill, number 7 for you.
Well,
tough to follow that one, huh?
Yes, it is. Well, one of the things I did when I was thinking about which books to pick for this show was to go back into this book I had kept for years, which was all these quotes from books that I really loved. And I would write them down, and that was all it was just a book of quotes. And one of the things in that book that I came across, which I had not read for a long time, were like pages and pages of quotes from a novel called Martha Quest by Doris Lessing. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, it's one of those novels that I read, again, sort of just at the right moment. It's about this adolescent who's trying to make her life and is having all kinds of problems with her family. And the book is, even more than I remember, absolutely filled with her love of books. It is like the most bookish book you can read. It is all about reading.
Would like that.
Yes. And for those of you that don't know this, Martha Quest is a novel that is set in South Africa, and it is about a young girl and her family. And it became, it started as Martha Quest. That was published in 1952, but there were four other books that came after it that were following Martha Quest. A Proper Marriage, A Ripple from the Storm, Landlocked, and then The Four-Gated City. But this first one is the one that has really stuck with me. And I think sometimes it is that thing where novels will help you through something. You know, indeed, Martha Quest helped me through my adolescence, I have to say. And part of that was her great love of reading. And here's a little bit. The book is absolutely full, as I say, of books. It occurred to her that the phrase, Martha is a great reader, was being used by herself exactly as her mother used it, and with as little reason. For what was she reading? She read the same books over and over again in between intervals of distracted daydreaming, in a trance of recognition, and in always the same place, under the big tree that was was her refuge through which the heat pumped like a narcotic. She read poetry not for the sense of the words, but for the melodies which confirmed the rhythm of the moving grasses and the swaying of the leaves over her head, or that ideal landscape of white cities and noble people which lay over the actual vistas of harsh grass and stunted trees like a golden mirage. She went through the house searching for something different. It was full of books. Her own room had shelves packed with fairy stories from her childhood and with poetry. In the living room, her parents' bookcases were filled with the classics, Dickens and Scott and Thackeray and the rest, inherited from prosperous Victorian households. These she had read years before, and she now read them again and with a feeling of being starved. Mm-hmm. It's just a gorgeous, I mean, again, what's great about it is this sort of ongoing story of how she gets out of this life by using books, you know, this life that she finds so oppressive, her family's farm, and then goes, and she goes on, as I say, there are five volumes, If You Get Caught by Martha Quest. I also love The Golden Notebook, but for me, Martha Quest was the book that really made a difference, and it is by Doris Lessing.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our list of greatest books, best, you know, must reads. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It is really amazing when you think about it, what a book, I mean, it can take you on amazing journeys, or like the guy you're talking about can influence major decisions in your life. And this kind of goes on. You've written books, several books, Bob, and one of them, you know, I can't remember the title now, but the whole Why We Should Read.
Right.
I wonder sometimes if we're not really a voracious reader, if you even stop to think about the influence that books, especially good books, have on you.
Yeah. You know, part of what I think about sometimes also related to that is, you know, which is the distraction, reading or living? And I say that in a way seriously, because living, to me, in a sense, is always, you know, it's filled with a kind of energy if it's going well, and but there's a kind of chaos. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find the center of it, the meaning, the purpose, the direction of it. So it looks, living itself is often chaotic. And on the other side with living, it's also, you know, a sense of all the drudgery of daily life. Mm-hmm. By contrast, you start to read, and you begin to see the shape of things. It's as if you see, you know, what's just under that drudgery, the possibilities, the sense of meaning of your own life. You sort of put it together often, the purpose of things. Because I think to a large extent you map your own story onto the story that you are reading.
I think that's really true. And I think that, you know, after Mary Poppins, I think Martha Quest was, you know, an emancipated woman. And, mm-hmm. and she gave me some idea of what that meant, which was really important at the time.
Yeah. We are talking about must reads, about top 10 books of all time, according to our book experts here this morning. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about must-reads, the top 10 books of our book experts, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Robert Waxler, recently retired English professor at UMass Dartmouth. We also love to hear what books you'd like to add. What's a must-read? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, what's next on your list, Bob?
The next one I have is Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. Now, I chose this in part because, for me, reading is always rereading. And I was thinking, here's a book that is just about 200 years old and has caught the popular imagination in a way that very few books ever have. And it's a kind of book that many people, I would guess, think they know. And they actually don't know it. There's so many, because there have been so many films. This is woven into the popular imagination. So the classic example of that issue is the monster is not really Frankenstein. Right? It's Victor Frankenstein, who is the creator of the monster,
yeah.
The doctor. And then there's the monster who is the monster, and he is unnamed. And it's interesting that he is unnamed in that context because he's sort of seeking his own self and his own identity. And he's also not the the monster who sort of, you know, walks and grunts a lot with his arms out there, you know, in some of the movies. He is a monster, if he is a monster, who speaks. And he's actually probably more elegant in his speech than any other character when you begin to look at it more closely, which is interesting also, because then you wonder, you know, what is Mary Shelley and all her complexity really thinking about here? Should we empathize with this monster? Are there things that every human being often thinks about as being monstrous, but in fact, maybe we should think about this monster and all those other things that supposedly we think of as monstrous as being part of human nature, but empathize with the monster rather than not. And here also I was thinking, you know, here's Mary Shelley. When she starts writing this, she's only 19 years old, which to me is
also amazing incredible. When you think about that. Yeah.
19
yeah,
years
yeah.
old, and she's produced one of the great works, I think, of all times in terms of novels. How does she come up with these incredible, mythical, in-depth ways of thinking about the complexity of the human experience? I find it just absolutely fascinating. So you have here, among other things, what some people might even think of as the first science fiction story as well. And you certainly have a story about the potential problems with science as science is just developing. And that has become mythological, right? I mean, anybody thinks about science these days and, you know, the extension of science and how far it might go and the potential that it might go too far. So you immediately think, oh, this is Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. This is you know, this is going to be monstrous. It's going to be destructive. But in a way, all of that comes out of this story. It's all there. And at the same time, there are issues about gender, feminism. You know, what does it mean to create something? Where is the mother in this? You've got Victor Frankenstein. You've got Frankenstein creating this monster, in a way, a father and son relation, but he's doing it without a woman, without the mother figure. And so he's sort of playing the role of God, which is another issue. Mm-hmm. You know, to what extent should human beings try to, you know, reach beyond their own human limitations and believe that they somehow can create life out of death? But where is the feminine side of things here? Where is the real love? Where is the sense of responsibility or the vulnerability? And to what extent is he somehow trying to just protect himself against all those inevitabilities once he actually creates the monster? So there's a huge complexity in this story,
yeah,
filled with a lot of great thematic issues. And it's, to me, remarkable, not only because it's gone for 200 years, but that here is this 19-year-old, essentially.
Right. And that still stands up after all this time.
And stands up so well.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, because we did that, actually, as a townwide read a few years back.
Yeah.
And I was surprised how many people got stuck in that novel right at the beginning, because there's that long series of letters sort of right at the beginning.
Well, that's right.
And they were like, they couldn't get past the letters. I'm like, really? This is just keep going. You know, it gets better. But it's interesting how a modern reader can have trouble with that novel for that reason, that the language is too rich almost for a modern reader, but a classic.
Yeah. All right. What's your next?
Let me just say one other thing about that, because it's an important point structurally. You have actually three narrators, which very few people would think about it unless they really got into it. Because you have Walt in the start, where this guy's heading toward the Arctic, and he's writing these letters to his sister. And then Frankenstein comes on deck, and you find him in the water. And then you get his story, which is sort of related to Walton's story, and then it's almost as if you get the inside story when the monster shows up and he tells his own story.
Right.
And you sort of reminded, everybody has a story. Everybody has a story.
Right. All right, number eight for you.
All right, so this was a hard choice because I knew I wanted to pick a Virginia Woolf book. I couldn't figure out which Virginia Woolf book to pick. It was not easy. And I discovered Virginia Woolf in college. I had never heard of her. I'd never read. In fact, a funny story is that I actually was reading Quentin Bell's biography of her at that time and absolutely fell apart when I discovered she had killed herself because I had no idea. I mean, I didn't know it was coming. I had no, it was like the worst possible ending. But what I did learn was about some really beautiful writing, and I decided that the book that I had to bring of all of her, and she's, of course, written novels, she's written short stories, but what I most was pulled by was her diaries, and specifically my first introduction to her diaries, which was a writer's diary, which was edited by her husband after she died. You can now, of course, you could buy all the diaries, but this was specifically about her writing. And it really is a fascinating look at her life and the life of a writer. And somebody wrote, oh, who was it? It was Susan Hill wrote this great description of what this book is like. She writes, "The diary introduced me to the woman and led me to her books, which came as a revelation, as they did to her contemporaries. The shock of discovering her style, the passionate observations of life and places and people has never really left me. I pick up a writer's diary every day at random. It opens on her description of visiting Thomas Hardy, on her ecstatic race across the final pages of The Waves, on how hurt she is by a bad review in The Times, on Leonard's opinion of To the Lighthouse, or how she cares that Lytton Strachey is getting more attention than she is. It has so many moods, contains so much intelligence, opinion, feeling, and gossip. It's a record of the times through which she was living while writing. The whole of Bloomsbury is here." And you can just dive into this at any point. There's a really funny little bit about Ulysses in here where she says, she writes, "I should be reading Ulysses and fabricating my case for and against. I have read 200 pages so far, not a third, and have been amused, stimulated, charmed, interested by the first two or three chapters to the end of the cemetery scene, and then puzzled, bored, irritated, and disillusioned by a queasy undergraduate scratching his pimples. And Tom, great Tom, thinks this on a par with War and Peace. An illiterate, underbred book, it seems to me, the book of a self-taught working man, and we all know how distressing they are, how egotistic, insistent, raw, striking, and ultimately nauseating." And she goes on, not a fan of Ulysses, was she? Although she eventually changes her mind on that. And she talks, she has, of course, a lot of mental illness, so there's a lot in here about her nervous breakdowns and how she gets through it. The great thing about any diary is that you can truly dip into it and dip out of it again. You can open it up to any page and find something of interest. And I think that diary reading, I am also a diary writer, so perhaps this is part of what, and but part of what I learned, I was writing diaries before I read Virginia Woolf's, but I think that they are really interesting about how writers live their lives, or whoever might be keeping the diary. But in her case, a really interesting dive into her writing life. And this particular volume, all put in specifically about her writing, is A Writer's Diary by Virginia Woolf. But feel free to pick up any Virginia Woolf. Start with a short story. They're great, too.
She is great.
All right. What's your next book, Bob?
My next book is Night by Elie Wiesel. And there, obviously, in many ways, a well-known book. But I thought about it as a book that needed to be reread again and again because it in some ways, when I think about the Holocaust and I think about Night, obviously, in relation to the Holocaust, I think, you know, here was a extraordinary turning point in the mid 20th century, which we're never completely going to recover from. And what you've got in Night are these fundamental questions, not solutions, but fundamental questions that are being asked about the meaning of humanity and of our relationship with God and the rest of the world that has no answer at all, at least since the 1940s. So we have a scene, for example, I remember a very powerful scene toward the middle of the book, and they're in the camps, and people are brought out into the courtyard. There's going to be a hanging, and there are three people on the gallows, but in the middle of the three is a young boy, an innocent boy, an angel, and all these prisoners have been brought out to watch this, obviously, as an example of what could happen and the terror of it. And as they're looking, you begin to see that this one boy, so innocent, is so young and weightless. Once they begin to activate the gallows and the bodies fall, his body cannot easily be pulled down by the gravity, so he's sort of swinging there half dead, whereas at least the other people with the weight of their bodies have their necks broken fairly quickly. So he's in this particular kind of agony, and you see, and you get the feeling that you're in that crowd. You're looking, within the courtyard, among all those other people, at this one innocent boy, this angel who's sort of just swinging there back and forth between life and death. And somebody shouts from the crowd, where is God? Mm-hmm. Where is God now? And then someone else sort of points up there, up toward the boy, and he says, he's there. He's there on the gallows. This kind of suggestion that this innocent, the boy himself, who had this kind of spiritual force, has died. And my sense is, it's not just a question of where is God, but where is humanity? How could this possibly happen? And so you have throughout the story of Night just this sense of deep questions of the night and the darkness, and you wonder if there's any light left.
All right, Jill, what's number 8 for you?
Number 8 for me is, and you knew, Mindy, this was inevitable, I was going to bring some Proust with me.
Of course.
Proust, the book that I am talking about is actually the last in his series, In Search of Lost Time, and it is called Finding Time Again. And I think it will be really surprising to those of you, again, that have never taken on the challenge of reading Proust, and I absolutely admit it is a challenge. Had they not come out with a whole new series of translations, and had I not had somebody to read aloud with me the entire works of Proust, I would never have made it. I did not. I had tried many times before, previously on my own, could never get through the first volume. But one of the things that you learn by the time you get to this last volume, Finding Time Again, is that how much of this novel is about writing novels and is about writing in general and about living. And it is really, he goes on to these beautiful speeches about writing and the importance of writing. He writes, for example, "I slowly became aware that the essential book, the only true book, was not something the writer needs to invent in the usual sense of the word, so much as to translate, because it already exists within each of us. The writer's task and duty are those of a translator." And it's that kind of sort of meditation on writing that happens in this last volume. So even if you have not read any of the rest of it, you should, in theory, be able to get something out of this one. More than in the 6 volumes that precede it, we're really made aware that Proust is a philosopher as much as a novelist. And he does talk a lot about writing in this last volume. Here's just a little bit more. "It is only out of a habit derived from the insincere language of prefaces and dedications that writers talk about my reader. In reality, each reader, when he is reading, is uniquely reading himself." So just really great. And you will notice there's sort of a theme about a lot of the books I choose is that they're really books about books and books about reading and writing. Mm-hmm. And so Marcel Proust, Finding Time Again, is really a beautiful piece of writing, not just about his family and his life, but about reading and writing.
All right. You have one more book, Bob. What's your last book?
Well, I began to think that we were giving short stories a, you know, a little bit of a short shrift. So I thought that at least one short story book might be in order. And I think James Baldwin is underrated anyway. So there's a number of really good short story books, but I began to think about this book called Going to Meet the Man by James Baldwin. That's the title of the book. It's also the title of a very good story in the book that Baldwin wrote about white consciousness in the South and how the almost by ritual a lot of the prejudice and racist attitudes were being passed from one generation to the next to make a man of a son, of a young man. And it's an extraordinarily powerful piece. But one of the things that I have always found particularly interesting is the way Baldwin, as a black man, can so deeply penetrate the white consciousness. It's really a remarkable story at that level and a great celebration of imagination, of Baldwin's imagination. But there's another story that I find even more interesting, and I think it's one of the best stories of the last half century or so. It's called Sonny's Blues by Baldwin, and it's about two brothers. They grow up in Harlem. One of them's a teacher. The other one is wants to play jazz. And he's a blues, and he's a musician, but he also takes heroin. So part of the story becomes a story of how the two brothers interact and don't interact. And as the story proceeds, you see by slow kind of incremental rhythm, the teacher, who is a very kind of, you know, a mainstream, traditional person who's done everything possible to keep his heart cold against his brother, even though he cares about his brother, slowly sees his heart sort of melting as he moves back toward his brother and toward some empathy and some understanding. And part of what he understands, and to me this is important not just in terms of the story, but really in terms of the whole drug problem, which is, I think, part of my interest in it, and is that he learns the importance of listening. That each person has their own story. His brother Sonny is playing it through the music, but each person is suffering, and it's necessary, Baldwin is saying, it's almost an ethical demand for us to listen closely to the stories of others, because in a way they are our stories as well. Mm. And my feeling, when I think about it, even in terms of even of the drug issues that we have today, is that this is something that we all can learn a lot from, that rather than attempting to impose our values and our life, as the older brother was at the beginning, onto somebody else's life and say, look, this is the way you should live, we should instead listen closely to the story of the other person. Because each person has their own unique story. And they want to tell that story. They have a great desire to tell it. There's one short passage in here which I'd like to read it, which I think is, you know, just remarkable in so many ways. It comes at the very toward the end of the story. Sonny, the younger brother, the addict, but also the person who plays great music, is up on a bandstand with a small group and. He's getting ready to play, and they're all gathering together. And there's a leader of the band is named Creel. So it says he, that's Creel. He and his boys were up there keeping it new at the risk of ruin, destruction, madness, and death in order to find new ways to make us listen. For while the tale of how we suffer and how we are delighted and how we may triumph is never new, it always must be heard. There isn't any other tale to tell. It's the only light we've got in all this darkness. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important to keep that in mind. It's a great story, Sonny's Blues.
All right. Jill, you're
and my final pick is another children's book, I have to say, but I think it is such a good book for anybody to be reading right in these particular times in which we're living. It is The Story of Ferdinand by Munro Leaf, with drawings by Robert Lawson. Yes. And may I just say, it is about a bull who doesn't want to fight in a bull ring, who follows his own path, who is gentle and kind to everyone. As the writer writes, he wouldn't fight and be fierce no matter what they did. He just sat and smelled, and the banderillos were mad, and the picadors were madder, and the matador was so mad he cried because he couldn't show off with his cape and sword. So they had to take Ferdinand home. And for all I know, he is sitting there still under his favorite cork tree, smelling the flowers just quietly. He is very happy.
I read this book last night to my grandson.
Did you really?
He loves this book. And what's really funny is the part where he goes to sit on the bee, as he literally put his hand over his mouth, you know, and said, "And what do you think happened? He stung him." Yes. And when they take him away to go to the bullfight,
right,
he shrieked, "Oh no!" Yes.
It is a great story, and it is also illustrated by the great Robert Lawson. Yeah. And everyone should be reading
it's
it
great.
Right
and
now.
Then when he gets out into that bullring and sits down, and my grandson said, "What's he doing? He's smelling the flowers in the lady's hair." So in our last couple of minutes, we should mention that this picking a top 10 is a really tough thing, and it is very subjective. I mean, what Absolutely. One person thinks of the greatest book of all time, somebody else might not think so.
Yeah, and I think, again, the choices change. I do think that this is not completely subjective in the sense that there are books that we can legitimately say are good books.
Classics, yeah.
They are classics. They're going to last. They offer endless surprises. And they are not only favorite books, but books which have a kind of intellectual energy to them. They have emotion, and they also have, through language, a kind of conceptual structure to them. And they offer so much to everybody. So, on that level, it isn't fair to say, I don't think. What sometimes people do say, well, it's all a matter of opinion.
What's interesting, in this book, My Ideal Bookshelf, one of the interesting features of it is that they don't just ask, like English teachers or librarians who it is that are on their favorite bookshelves. Mm-hmm. They ask musicians and architects and all kinds of different people. And it's really interesting to see how those shelves of the top 10 books change depending on what your interest is.
Right.
So the fact that most of my books have to do with reading is not surprising. but when you look at what legal scholars are reading, and all kinds of people who do different kinds of things, the shelves are really quite different. Mm. And one of the other great things about this book is that it has illustrations of their bookshelves. So somebody has not both asked them what books they would want to most read, what their ideal bookshelf would look like, and also about what they actually look like. And they give little descriptions of why they love what they love. And often it has something very, there's some very personal meaning to it, they choose.
It's always fun to go into people's houses and see what's in their bookshelves. Yeah. But I want to thank you both for taking on this assignment of picking your top 10 must reads. We'll say that rather than favorites, because we know that changes. Robert Waxler, recent retired English professor at UMass Dartmouth, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
And we will have a list to all the books we talked about today and last month at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.